Air Temple Island, Yue Bay, Dicho. After breakfast, Cora and company went out to the courtyard to consider their day. They were still at it when, a few minutes later, a sandy-haired man in the elaborate uniform of a Republic City civil servant ran up the path leading down to the ferry docks and presented himself to them with an elaborate bow. "Oh, hey, Chin," said Cora casually. "What brings you all the way out here?" "If it's Councilwoman Okamoto again," she added, a slight note of warning entering her voice. Chin smiled and shook his head. "No, no, Avatar," he assured her. "I think she's finally taken the hint. I have a delivery for..." He removed a large folder from one of the capacious sleeves of his bureaucrat's tunic and peered through his spectacles at the address on it, then went on. "Caitlin Hutchins. Am I pronouncing that correctly?" "Close enough," said Kate with a smile. "Excellent," he said, opening the folder to reveal a large envelope with a neatly printed cover sheet attached. "I'll just need you to sign for the package. In addition to the proper licensure and acknowledgement that all the relevant documents have been received and properly filed, His Excellency the Commissioner of the Bureau for Animal Control has asked me to inform you that the Republic City Police have been provided with a detailed description of your..." Chin squinted at the page. "I beg your pardon," he said, sounding dismayed. "This must be a typographical error. Is it a tigerdillo or a tigervark? This just says tiger." He shook his head. "Oh dear, that'll need to be corrected post-haste." "No, it's quite correct," Kate assured him. Then, raising her voice slightly, she called, "Serge? Serge?" With a tigerish sound that might almost have been a faintly grumpy, "What?" Serge came around the berry bush he'd been napping behind and padded toward them. In that moment, Cora had the unique pleasure of seeing Chief Civil Servant Chin, a man easily dismayed by paperwork problems, but famously unflappable under any other circumstances, outright dumbfounded. It only lasted a second, after which he stopped goggling, pulled himself together, and said, "How remarkable," before handing Kate the envelope and an elaborate fountain pen. "Sign here, here, and initial here, here, and here, please." Kate took the pen and envelope, juggled them a bit so they were in the correct hands, and then took a moment to work out how to sign and initial with the old-fashioned pen in such a way that she didn't end up smeared to the elbow with ink. Do they not have lefties in this world? She wondered wryly as she negotiated the task, then handed the pen and the signed sheet back to Chin. "Thank you." He made the pen and paper disappear into his sleeve with a practiced ease they all admired, then swept them an elaborate bow, doffing his pom-pom-topped hat in the process, wished them all a very pleasant day, and trotted away. Cora watched him go, a half-smile on her face, then turned to the others and observed, "I didn't have the heart to tell him we're all going to end up on the same ferry boat together in a minute." Then, putting thumb and forefinger in the corners of her mouth, she let out the kind of whistle that would stop every taxicab on the block in downtown New Avalon. A moment later, the great white shape of a polar bear dog, Serge's lunch date from the day before, bounded around the corner of the ladies' quarters and galumphed eagerly up to them. "Neary," said Cora cheerfully, rubbing the giant dog's head. "Good girl. Want to go into town? Oh, have you met Serge?" Neary turned and lowered her great head to look Serge in the face. The tiger gazed back for a second, then closed his eyes and rubbed his cheek affectionately against hers, to contented sounds from both. Cora blinked. "I guess so," she said, then grinned and said, "Okay, we're off." They made for an eye-catching group even in Republic City. A couple of brown-haired foreign girls in what were, by local standards, rather odd clothes, the elder carrying a walking stick, the younger wearing a sword. A large, black-striped, orange beast resembling nothing so much as an unarmored tigerdillo, and a dark-skinned, violet-haired, thoroughly pregnant young woman sitting sidelong on the back of what was unmistakably the Avatar's polar bear dog, bearing a lemur on her shoulder. Compared to that lot, the gangly teenage air nomad and the Avatar herself seemed almost commonplace to the patrons of the Railway Square street market. They browsed the market for half an hour or so, making small purchases and enjoying the convivial atmosphere. When they regrouped near the statue of Fire Lord Zuko, Korra was giggling about something. "You appear to have discovered something amusing," Caitlin observed. Korra angled a thumb back toward the marketplace with a grin. "My cousin Kemba has a stall here, selling Southern Water Tribe handicrafts, blankets, wall hangings, that kind of thing. She tells me Corwin and Utna were here yesterday. She took him for a northerner. Just finished 5 minutes on how he needs to get more vitamin D." She giggled again, then said, "You'd have to know Kemba." The United Republic Museum, as it turned out, was a handsomely presented and meticulously curated institution, housed in a sprawling and rather impressive but not intimidating building downtown. It covered somewhat more than just the relatively short history of the United Republic of Nations. It also included a section on the connection between Dicho and Zipang, from various primeval encounters between worlds that were not recognized as such at the time, up through the early modern contacts and the process by which the two worlds finally and formally acknowledged one another, opened trade routes, and whatnot. Utna soaked it all up, pleasantly reminded of the 2 days she'd spent in the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto, not long after finding herself in Midgard. The parallels were many, exploring a curious new world through the medium of how its own inhabitants saw their shared past. But one thing was very different. Though she'd been part of a group at the Royal Ontario, she'd also been alone in a very fundamental and, on the second day, peculiarly painful way. Today, not so much. Case in point. In the wing about the history of Republic City itself, there was a large and thoughtful display of artifacts and explanatory placards concerning a major civil disturbance that had taken place in the city some time before. At the Royal Ontario, she'd have absorbed this in silent contemplation, filing the bits she didn't understand away for later filling in of the missing context that would hopefully cause them to make some retroactive sense. Here, she could just ask Corwin. She was helped a bit by the fact that the United Republic Museum, virtually alone among the places she'd been to in Dicho so far, had mostly bilingual signage. Half of it was in Tongu, of course, but the other half at least attempted to be in standard. A lot of the time, the standard part made about as much sense as the directions for that Neo-Taiwanese crystal dubber Caitlin had bought on eBay one time, but she could at least usually tell when a given placard was about, say, the people depicted in an adjacent photograph, and not something to do with the historical value of the picture frame. She still had to ask Corwin a lot of the time, but at least she had a place to start. She was standing looking at one of the photographs in a large and artfully presented montage, set along a rough timeline of the incident, when it hit her. "Hang on a second," she said, indicating one of the photos near the beginning of the line. "That's Korra." Corwin looked. "Yes, it is," he agreed. The picture showed her standing on the steps of an imposing-looking building, Utna assumed it was City Hall, declaiming into a pleasingly retro-looking cluster of microphones. "But then this?" Utna pointed to the explanatory placard beneath that photo. "Am I reading this right? Is it translated right?" "If it is, and I am, it says this photo was taken in 2289. "Yeah, that sounds about right," said Corwin, not appearing surprised. He took a closer look at the placard in question, then frowned. Has Cora never come here? You'd think she would have told them by now that their standard translations are a bit tragic. But no, you're reading it right. Cora's... let me think. She'll be 138 next month. Utina took a moment to gauge how likely it was that he was messing with her. Then, bearing in mind all the different ways in which the lifespans of other people she and Corwin knew had been extended, she asked wryly, "Okay, so is that an avatar thing, or a drank from a magic well thing, or..." Corwin looked back at her, his expression becoming suddenly pensive, and his voice was slightly sad as he replied, "Actually, I don't know." She blinked, startled by the sudden change in his demeanor. Sensing that this wasn't the place to explore the matter further, she touched his arm, telling him with that gesture and her eyes, all she needed after all this time, that she wanted to come back to it another time. Then she left him to his thoughts for a moment and made her way down the timeline of the incident. This took her perhaps a quarter of an hour, allowing for time to both read and then untangle the photo captions. By the time she reached the end of the exhibit, she thought she had a reasonably good handle on what had happened, and it didn't give the impression that it had been good times. The timeline ended at a glass display case containing a mannequin clothed in a strange and dismaying costume, dominated by a hooded coat and a freaky mask that looked like it might be smirking. Utina stood regarding the mask a while, considering what it must have been like at the time. In this well-lit museum gallery, under glass and on the head of a lifeless dummy, it looked vaguely comical. But Utina suspected that to someone on the receiving end of that cold porcelain smirk, it had been anything but. "Okay," said Utina. "I'm getting the distinct impression that this is not one of the good guys." "No," said Corwin, stepping up alongside her and putting a hand on her shoulder. "No, it is not. This is a representation of Noatak, alias Amon, the figurehead of the Equalist Revolution. Actually, more of an insurrection, but I suppose the difference there is usually who wins," he added dryly. Utina looked more closely at the accompanying placard, able to decipher more of its fractured standard with that context. "A powerful bloodbender? That doesn't sound encouraging." "No," Corwin agreed. "It's pretty much what it says on the tin. A particularly vicious spin on waterbending, sort of thing the phrase black art was coined for." Utina folded her arms and regarded the mannequin. "Dark magician in a creepy mask leading a millennial cult. That's not obvious or anything." "Being obvious was the whole idea," Corwin told her. "Keep people looking at the spectacle so they don't notice the real chicanery. Think of the guy who ran that Black Rose thing." Diedlet Satori Mandeville Memorial Institute, Gerardo, Republic of Bajor, Centaurus Sector. Dr. Roland Tiefeld looked up from the datapad he was examining and considered the two well-dressed young men who sat across his desk from him. The elder was regarding him with a frank and likable expression, the very picture of a youthful, idealistic researcher, ready to get started on what he considered important work. The younger, identified in the documentation on Tiefeld's datapad as a graduate research assistant, looked ever so slightly but politely bored. Remembering his own grad school days, Tiefeld couldn't help but smile a little, internally. That was a long time ago, but he could still recall how dull the endless round of conferences with administrators and corporate executives had been. Conferences in which he had been expected only to appear and let his elders do all the conferring. "Well, Professor Nemiro," said Tiefeld, putting down the datapad, "everything seems to be in order. Though I confess I'm surprised that you've chosen to begin your study so late in the school year." Professor Hideki Nemuro smiled engagingly. "Oh, not at all, Dr. Tiefeld," he replied. "This is the perfect time to do it. When your students return from their spring recess, they'll be entering by far the most stressful part of the academic year. What better time to conduct a study on the incidence of stress disorders in high-achieving students?" "I suppose you do have a point there," Tiefeld agreed. "Now, all this is in our project abstract," Nemuro went on, "but I want to make absolutely certain I've made it as plain as can be. We are not here to replace or supplant the student counseling services your institution already offers. I've read a great deal of Professor Hanley's body of work, and I would never presume that I or Kuroda here could do the job half as well as he can. We're merely here to catalog this school year's stress factors and observe and record the student body's responses to them. We'll refer those volunteers who need actual help to the people already best placed to deliver it. This is basic long-term research we're doing here. There'll be no names or other identifiable specifics in any of our documentation." Tiefeld nodded. "Thank you, Professor, and I appreciate your position on the matter," he said. "At this institution's predecessor, we did have certain difficulties with student counseling services that were imposed from without." "Well, Dr. Tiefeld, you have my personal assurance that there will be no such problems this time," said Nemuro positively, with a nod that was so enthusiastic it was nearly a seated bow. DSM's president reflected for a moment longer on what he'd just read and heard, then said, "Very well. The Institute is still growing, so we have a second residence group that's mostly vacant this year. I'll check with Residential Life and find out where the best place to put you will be. You should be able to start setting up tomorrow." "That sounds perfect," said Nemuro. "I believe classes resume a week from then?" "That's correct," Tiefeld confirmed. "Excellent. Plenty of time for us to set up." He smiled. "It's not as if we have many needs as regards equipment, after all. We're mainly just talking to people." He rose and offered a hand. "Thank you for your help, Dr. Tiefeld. It may be some time before the major benefits of our work reach the field, but without basic research like this..." "Of course," agreed Tiefeld. "We're always happy to support the advancement of the academic sciences." He shook first Nemuro's hand, then his assistant's. "Good day, Professor Nemuro, Mr. Kuroda. I'm sure we'll be seeing each other often over the next few weeks." "I'm sure," Nemuro echoed. "Good day, Dr. Tiefeld." As they were crossing the footbridge over Highway 1 to Main Parking B, Toga Kiryu gave his graduate advisor a sardonic look and remarked, "That was easy." "Why should the poor man be suspicious of us?" Soji Mikage replied, shrugging. "Our credentials are perfectly valid. The University of Tothis is a fully accredited institution." "And a wholly owned subsidiary of Shrine Investment Partners." "One would almost think you wanted this to be harder, Mr. Kuroda," Mikage chided him, flipping the remote control locks of their rental car. "Perhaps I've merely grown suspicious of success, Professor," said Toga dryly. Republic City Park, Republic City, Dicho. "This is my favorite spot in the whole city," Cora proclaimed, plopping down on the grassy slope of a small hill in the middle of the park. The hill would have been the end of a peninsula jutting out into the lake, except that a narrow strip of water crossed the isthmus just behind it. This rendered it an island, reachable by a pair of handsome stone-arch bridges on either side. "I can see why," said Anthy, smiling. Moving carefully, she descended the ramp Cora had earthbent up to Neri's side for her, then seated herself next to the Avatar. Cora leveled the grass out again, waited for Kate to unsling the picnic basket they'd picked up at the market from Neri's back, then nodded to the dog, who rose to her feet and waded happily into the lake. It's not just because it's pretty and tranquil, Cora said. It has sentimental value. She indicated a small round dedication plaque at the foot of the stone lantern which stood behind them, at the top of the low hill that was the island. Anthy turned, leaning back on an elbow, and read it. On this spot, in 170 ASC, Avatar Korra was formally welcomed to Republic City by Seaman Telegrapher Gamu of the United Forces. Anthy's smile widened a little. That's sweet, she said. Was there some sort of formal reception? Anne asked. Nah, Korra said, then corrected herself. Well, there was, but later, and it was just a show. You know how those things are. Gamu was my real introduction to Republic City. A good man. I miss him. That's why I let the city put this plaque here, she added, gesturing to the marker again. Most of them I vetoed. She rolled her eyes. I don't think anyone today really wants to know that I was once arrested for vigilantism on San Juan Bridge, for instance, she added, drawing a laugh from the others. Like Corwin and Nutana had the day before, the five, or eight, depending on how you count them, ate a picnic lunch, enjoying the afternoon sunshine and the restful greenness of the park. After lunch, they turned to various gentle recreations. Neri and Serge frolicked in the lake. Kate and Anne went across the bridge to the west into a small meadow, and there did a bit of work with their blades covered, so as not to alarm passers-by, while Nima watched and cheered them on. Anthy and her lemur played with a toy boomerang the former had bought from Korra's distant cousin Kemba in the market. Anthy would throw it out over the lake and then wait while the lemur intercepted and retrieved it, with the added bonus that if he missed it, it would come back anyway. You've got a pretty good eye for that, Korra remarked as Anthy sent the boomerang soaring out over the water again. Thank you, said Anthy. As a girl, I honed my skill by skipping rocks on a pond near our home. I was always better at it than my brother. Do you have any brothers or sisters, Korra? Korra shook her head. Nope, only child. I was more than my poor parents could keep up with all by myself, I think. She lay back on the grass, hands behind her head, and smiled up at the sky. Where's your brother these days? She wondered. He died, said Anthy. Korra blinked, then sat up again, her face reddening. Before she could stammer out an apology, though, Anthy smiled and patted her arm. It was long ago, she said. I can't say I'm over it. One never really is over such a thing. But nowadays I can focus on the good parts rather than the bad. I love him very much, and I do what I can to honor his memory. He was a good man, a kind and just man. Utrina is very like him in many ways, as is Corwin. Korra smiled at that and lay back down again. They're a matching set, all right. She turned her head so that she could meet Anthy's eye, her smile becoming a little wry. Feels a little weird saying that to you, of all people. Oh, I quite agree, believe me, Anthy assured her. Yesterday, while you were all off doing whatever you were doing, I had a fascinating conversation with your friend Jinora, she went on, her tone light and casual. Much of it centered on the three of us, what we mean to each other and whatnot. She seems to be a woman who likes to know exactly where everyone stands. Korra laughed. Yeah, she's that. I'm not sure I was able to satisfy her entirely in that regard, Anthy went on with a mischievous little glint, as we aren't completely sure of all the particulars ourselves, but I gave it my best shot. She accepted the boomerang from the lemur yet again, thanking him cordially. You've made a friend, Korra observed. Between you and Corwin, you'll be taking half the island back with you. She glanced across the channel, to where Nima sat watching Caitlin and Juniper practice. Particularly if Nima runs away to join your circus. "Mmm," said Anthy sympathetically, petting the lemur. "Jinora told me she's somewhat enamored of Corwin." "That's Jinora ease for hopelessly besotted with," Cora explained helpfully. "Not that she'd ever make her own play for him, particularly now that he's married. She's too honorable for that. And anyway, she's got this crazy idea that she's ugly." "I know," said Anthy. "She mentioned it to me yesterday." "Not looking for sympathy, I don't think. Just presenting it as what she perceives as a matter of fact. She's a very sincere young woman. I like her." "Everybody likes Nima," Cora confirmed. "How can you not? She's like a gold coin. Says what she's worth right on her face." Anthy chuckled. "Well," she said, "we'll just have to try and disabuse her of some of her wilder notions a little bit at a time, I suppose. Eh, Makoto?" she added, scritching the lemur, who purred contentedly. Cora looked over, smiling. "Is that Makoto as in sincerity or Makoto as in truth?" she wondered. "Does it matter?" Anthy replied cheerfully. "I suppose not," Cora acknowledged with a laugh. Corwin was slightly out of sorts for the rest of their time at the museum. In fact, Utrina realized as she watched him gaze thoughtfully at a display of the widely varied currencies that could be found in Republic City at the time of its founding, his demeanor reminded her of the way she'd felt at the Royal Ontario. He was in the grip of a melancholy that had seized him suddenly, or possibly one that he had been carrying for a while, and that he had abruptly ceased to be able to fend off. He did his best to conceal it while they had lunch in the museum's excellent commissary, and for the hour and a half or so it took them to finish the West Gallery after lunch, but he had never been any good at hiding his feelings in general, or from Utrina in particular, and she saw through the attempt without even trying. She let it alone, though, until they left the building. As they descended the marble front steps, she took his hand and said, "Hey, talk to me." "About what?" he asked unconvincingly. "You know what," Utrina told him. "You've been bummed out since I asked you about Cora's age. I don't get it. She's young. She doesn't seem any older than I am. Surely that's a good thing." "It is," Corwin agreed. "But..." They reached the car, but rather than get in, he stopped next to it and turned to face her. "We don't know why she is. If you ask her, and I have, it won't surprise you to learn that I was a catastrophically blunt 5-year-old," he added with a flash of wryness that made her smile for a moment. "She just laughs it off with something about clean living and deep chi reserves. But really, I'm pretty sure she doesn't know. And if we don't know how or why she's stayed young for so long, then we can't know how long it'll last." Corwin hesitated, eyes downcast, considering what he was to say next. Then he raised them to hers and went on, "That's why I'm so angry at the White Lotus. I've tried to hide it from her, so as not to pile on any more angst, but I am. I'm furious. 'Cause, see..." He paused, wrestling with the words. Utrina took his hands, linking her fingers with his, and he went on, "Nal and I, we're used to the idea that most of our loved ones are likely to make it at least as far as we do. And the ones who don't, well, we'll have plenty of warning at least. But Cora? She isn't aging, but as far as we know, she's still mortal. She might live until Fimbulvetr, or tomorrow afternoon she might just stop. We just don't know. Nobody knows. She doesn't know. So every day they stole from us." Corwin trailed off and closed his eyes, head bowed. Usna gathered him into a hug. It occurred to her that death was not, in and of itself, always an obstacle for Corwin. Not to put too fine a point on it, he had an apartment in Valhalla, and many of his best friends were dead people. But he was too obviously upset for her to mention it. Plainly, the situation was more complicated than that, and bringing it up would just have seemed flippant. Besides, she'd caught something of his mood herself now, and a cyclone of emotions and memories were rushing through her heart and head as she held him. It wasn't a time for splitting hairs. They stood there for perhaps as much as a minute, arms around each other, heads on each other's shoulders, just holding on, before he added quietly into her hair, "Well, I'm sort of taking it personally, is all I'm saying." Usna hugged him a little tighter, making a wordless sound of agreement. In his place, she'd have felt the same. She did feel the same, or something like it, at the thought that this had been done, this precious bond forcibly attenuated for years, because of her own reputation for, what would you even call it, contributing to karmic instability? How dare they? "We'll get some answers tomorrow," she promised him. "You bet we will," he agreed. They held on for another few moments, then stepped back and looked at each other, verging on tears and summoning matched wan smiles in their place. Then Utrina managed a grin and said, "Come on, we'll be late for the race." The Uehara Limited, countryside west of Uehara, Zipang. Amy, Rory, and Nall were all lounging around their compartment reading when the train entered a tunnel. None of them took any particular notice of this. The country west of Saikyo was hilly, so tunnels had been a common experience on the run to Uehara, until, somewhere in the ceiling above them, a bell rang. It reminded Rory and Amy of the ones that announced the end of class periods at DSM, except a little more musical and not as loud. They'd never heard this one before, though, and they looked up in mild surprise as it sounded. Rory glanced at Nall and saw that he was grinning, but before he could ask whether he knew what the bell meant, he heard another, much more peculiar sound. It was a sort of mechanical clatter, and it seemed to be coming from somewhere outside the train. And it was moving. It racketed invisibly along the wall of the compartment, from front to back, and faded away to the rear. Amy turned and looked back, not that there was anything to see but the bulkhead at the rear of the compartment, then faced front again and asked, "What was that?" "We just crossed the veil," Nall explained. "That was what the bell was for. The other noise, well, I'll show you when we stop in Bossing Se." He grinned again. "It's pretty cool." The train pulled into Bossing Se Central Station, having, as a limited, bypassed local stations at both the outer and inner walls and half a dozen places in between, 2 hours later, and the voice on the overhead, now speaking Tongyuan standard instead of Japanese in standard, told passengers that they were free to detrain at this stop if they wished, but that if they were going on to points west, they would please not go beyond the station concourse and be back aboard in no more than 30 minutes. Locking up the compartment behind them, the three climbed down onto the platform. "See?" said Nall, gesturing to the train. For a second, Amy and Rory didn't see what he was getting at, until they looked again and saw that the lettering on the side of their carriage had changed. No longer did it say Uehara Limited in alternating Japanese and standard. Now the non-standard markings were in Tongyu, and the standard lettering read Republic City Limited. Looking more closely, Rory saw that the lettered areas were hinged in the middle, like the numbers on old-fashioned digital alarm clocks. "I love this place," said Nall cheerfully. "It's like one of Sumire Kanzaki's spy movies. Come on, let's hit the concourse. There used to be a food stall out there that made the best egg custard tarts. Republic City Park, Republic City, Dicho. What finally drew Cora and her group away from their idyll on Gamu Island was neither hunger, for their picnic had been ample, nor nightfall, which was still hours away. It was music. This came drifting along on the early afternoon air from somewhere to the west, drawing first Caitlin, then all the rest, to follow and see where it led. This turned out to be a concert shell, similar to the one that stood on the Grand Common of Avalon Center Park. Kate had spent many a happy Foundation Day and New Year's Eve standing within earshot of that one, listening to the New Avalon Symphony Orchestra do their thing. This one had the band set up in front of it, not on it, because the shell itself was occupied by a group of colorfully costumed actors putting on a musical play of some kind for a moderately sized crowd. Having arrived, she would guess from the music she'd heard on the way over, sometime toward the end of Act One, Kate had very little idea what was going on, but the score wasn't bad. She made a mental note to look into including more parts for Erhu in some of her own works. The others caught up to her a minute or two later, at which point, seeing the actors' costumes, Cora laughed, keeping her voice down for the sake of nearby patrons of the arts. "Oh, man, Love Amongst the Dragons? Haven't seen this in a while," she said quietly. Turning to the others, she asked, "Do you guys want to stay for the rest of this? It's probably not going to make much sense without the first act." Anne grinned and replied, "I don't think we have a choice." She indicated her attentively listening swordmaster. "We'd need a taser to get Caitlin-sensei away from here now that she's interested in their orchestra." Cora turned and craned her head to see the stage over the audience's heads. "Let's see. Okay, yeah, it's the Hira'a acting troupe. That's a relief. The Ember Island players come through here every year on their tour and murder this one. These guys are all right." That seemed to settle the question. Without further consultation, they found seats at the end of a row near the back, where they wouldn't have to disturb anyone to get seated, and where Serge and Neri could lurk behind them without annoying anybody, then settled in to get their drama appreciation on. Future Industries Raceway Park, Future City, Dicho. Corwin and Utna were not, in fact, late for the race, but only by virtue of having run one of their own to get there in time. The man selling tickets recognized them, from the Tribune, presumably, and wouldn't hear of them sitting all the way at the back of the grandstand. Instead, he ushered them to what was obviously a VIP box, where most of the people seemed to be middle-aged and dressed as if for a night at the opera. They looked curiously at the dressed-down young foreigners being shown into their section, but without hostility. A few smiled and nodded to them, but most were just cordially indifferent. The man who seated them handed each a sheet of paper, on which was printed the afternoon's schedule of events. Utrina folded hers up and tucked it away in the top pocket of her frostproof shirt, since she couldn't read it anyway. From somewhere in the near distance, on the other side of the long, low buildings opposite the main straight grandstand, came the sounds of high-performance engines being revved and fettled as the racing teams got ready for the main event. "This isn't one of those places where everybody sings along with the national anthem, is it?" she asked Corwin with a smile. "I feel conspicuous enough without having to sing along to a song I don't know the words to, or the language it's in." Corwin grinned. "Some do, but nobody will think it's weird if you don't," he assured her. "I don't remember how it goes, my—" "Corwin!" a voice cried from off to their right. They turned to see a tall and handsome young man in an old-fashioned racing suit, all red and black leather with orange accents, standing in the grandstand aisle, his arms outstretched in welcome. He had a pair of matching leather gauntlets held loosely in one hand, From that wrist, a crash helmet dangled by its chin strap. "Hey, Ryo," said Corwin, delighted. He rose and went to shake the man's free hand. "I haven't seen you for goat dog's years, boy," said Ryo. "Where have you been keeping yourself?" "It's not where I've been keeping myself, it's where other people have been keeping me," Corwin replied. "Or keeping me out of. It's a long story. Jeez, man, look at you," he added, taking a half step back and spreading his hands. Ryo swung open the gate in the low wall surrounding the VIP box and stepped inside, mimicking the gesture in return. "I was about to say the same thing. You're huge, son!" "Don't you son me. You're what, 6 weeks older?" said Corwin, rolling his eyes. "And who is this astonishing personage?" asked Ryo, turning twinkling green eyes to Utna as she stepped up alongside Corwin. Corwin made introductory gestures. "Utna, meet Ryo Sato. I'm assuming he doesn't own the company yet, but you never know. I've been away for a while." Ryo grinned. "No, no, are you kidding? The only way I'll ever own this company is if my darling sister finally manages to write a check her talent can't cash, and the spirits won't allow that to happen. Then they'd have to deal with her," he added, his grin becoming a little bit toothy. "Ryo, this is Utna Tenjo." Corwin let Ryo take Utna's hand and get all the way down into his most elaborate bow, touching his forehead to the back of it, before he added with a sly little smile and a wink for her, "My wife." Ryo looked up, remaining in his bow, and gave a theatrically suspicious look first to Utna, then to Corwin. "What you are talking about, son?" he said skeptically. "I'm afraid it's true," said Utna, gently retrieving her hand and bowing to him Nihonia fashion. "I just found out the day before yesterday," she added, then shrugged. "Still trying to figure out how it happened." Ryo straightened up and gave a merry laugh, hands on hips. "Oh, you're good," he said. "You're very good." He turned to Corwin, pointing to Utna. "She's very good," he added, as if Corwin might not have noticed it before. A horn sounded somewhere off in the direction of the engine noises, which, Utna noticed, had settled down to a low rumble sometime while they'd been talking. Ryo looked up like a hunting dog. "Hark, I am summoned." He grinned at them again. "Wonderful meeting you. We'll simply have to get better acquainted after the race. Not in that way. You're married." He straightened up and adjusted the collar tab of his racing suit with a put-on air of affronted dignity. "Control yourself, woman." Then he clouted Corwin on the shoulder and said, "And you, my son, have some explaining to do. Cheer for us. Number 22, you can't miss us. We'll be the one with the maniac driving." He hurried off, calling back, "Ta-ta!" before vaulting the rail at the front of the grandstand, dropping lithely to the track, and dashing across toward the garages. "You know the most interesting people," Utna observed with a smile as they went back to their seats. "Avatars, airbenders, race car drivers." "Ryo's not driving," Corwin said with cheerful certainty. "Minami would never put up with that. He'll be backseating for her. Story of his life." The Future Industries' historic Grand Prix was a thrilling affair, and a kind of motor racing Utna had never seen before. She'd seen a number of races billed as vintage before. The Nekomi Institute of Technology Motor Club, of which she was a member, or had been. Was she, in fact, still a student at NIT? She'd have to check into that. It had been a very odd year. Held vintage and retro events quite often. Few of them were this vintage, though. Skinny tires and two-person crews vintage. The driver of car number 22 was indeed a woman, although beyond that Utna couldn't tell much. She had long, dark hair drawn back in a ponytail that trailed from under her helmet, but her goggles and a sort of bandit mask completely obscured her features. Watching her work, though, Utna was satisfied that Ryo had been right. The girl was certainly a maniac. She was a talented maniac, though. And though she spent the entire race flirting with the razor line between the aggression that wins races and the aggression that causes a humongous accident, she never quite strayed over it. On the occasion when she did come closest to a crash, it wouldn't have been her fault. A car that she was in the process of lapping had a blowout and nearly swerved into her. Catastrophe avoided by lightning reflexes and the sort of precise car control Utna associated with Dorothy Wainwright. By race's end, Utna had cheered herself temporarily hoarse and thought she had a decent idea what Rio had meant when he talked about his sister writing checks for her talent to cash. It had cashed them all right on this occasion, though. Car 22, Sato, Minami, and Rio, won the Grand Prix by nearly a full minute over the second-place finisher. Minami Sato turned out to be so like her brother in appearance that Utena at first took them for twins, like Miki and Kozue Kaworu. She was a little taller and a lot more feminine, obviously, but the lines of their faces were markedly similar, and they had the same emerald eyes and slightly wavy black hair. Minami had a lot more of it, falling down to her shoulder blades now that she'd taken it out of the ponytail she'd worn for racing. The Satos ran straight from the podium ceremony to intercept Corwin at Utna before they could reach the parking lot, so when they appeared, they were still just as they had come from the track. Minami, in particular, was sporting a serious reverse raccoon effect from her goggles and bandit mask, the latter still slung around her neck like an oily kerchief. Sitting in back, Rio had taken less of a spattering, although, as if to balance that, he'd plainly taken the brunt of the champagne spraying in the winner's circle. His hair was still dripping. "Corwin, it's true!" cried Minami cheerfully, lunging at him for a jubilant hug without regard to her smudged condition. "I thought Rio was just messing with me." "Nope, it's true," said Corwin, who didn't seem to mind. "How have you been, Minami?" "Oh, you know how it goes," Minami replied, falling into step beside him as he walked across the parking lot. "It's a never-ending whirl of social triumphs and technical marvels when you're a Sato. What about you? You're certainly looking good," she added with an uncomplicated smile. "I always told Rio you'd..." She came to a sudden halt, physical and verbal, as she caught sight of the Coromobile. "Is that..." She blinked. "That's a P2X. "No." She ran around to the back and looked at the license plate, then up at Corwin. "It's the P2X. How did you get this out of the Avatar Museum? Wait!" Then, with a look of gleeful realization, she ran back around and seized Corwin by the front of his jacket, giving him a shake. "Corwin, did you grow up to be a gentleman burglar?" she demanded, grinning widely into his face. "Do you have a heist team?" she went on, getting more and more excited as she explored the idea. Nodding toward Utena, she asked, "Is she your social engineer?" Spirits know he'd have to have one, she added wryly to Utena with a wink, making her giggle, before returning her gleeful eyes to Corwin. "Do you have a getaway driver? Can I be your getaway driver? I will literally change my face and let Rio have the company if I can be the getaway driver in your heist team."
"Well, you heard it here first, gang," said Rio happily. "Company's all mine now."
"Sorry to disappoint you both," Corwin said, gently disengaging Minami's hands from his jacket. "But I am not, in fact, a gentleman burglar." Eyeing her narrowly, he added, "And what was that crack about social engineering supposed to mean?" Minami pouted in disappointment. "Darn it! I thought I was finally going to get a chance to live my dreams." She turned to Utena. "So, if you're not his heist team social engineer, who are you?" She sighed, shoulders slumping, and added in a tone of exaggerated resignation, "Go ahead, tell me you're his girlfriend. Dash what few hopes I have left." Unable to keep from smiling, Utena replied, "Actually, we just got married." Minami threw back her head, forearm to brow,
and cried dramatically, "Oh, woe! Lamentations and rending of—" She seized the panel on the front of her double-breasted racing jacket, then frowned down at her hands and said in a more normal voice, "No, wait, this is Komodo rhino hide. I couldn't possibly rend it." She shrugged. "Guess that plan's out, then." Grinning at Utena, she went on, "I don't suppose I can interest you in a trade. My brother's not as smart, funny, or handsome, but he's rich and very obedient."
"Oi!" Ryo objected.
"Sorry, not today," said Utena, grinning. "Give me a little while for the shine to wear off, at least." Then she extended a hand. "Utena Tenjo."
"Minami Sato," said Minami cheerfully, giving the hand a solid pumping.
"So, who's hungry? I'm hungry. Dinner time." She started for the car, but Corwin stopped her with a hand on her shoulder, so that her feet almost walked out from under her before she could pull up.
"You're not getting in my nice, clean, borrowed, priceless historical relic in that condition," he told her, smiling, with a nod toward her oil-smudged, champagne-damp clothes.
"Oh, fine," Minami replied, pouting again. "We'll take my car, then." They stashed the Coromobile in Minami's racing garage, next to her racing car, where it would be secure, and then the four of them somehow crammed into a tiny convertible that put Utena in mind of Skuld's ancient Carmen Ghia. This did technically have a rear seat, but only in a sort of theoretical quantum physics way. Still, Utena had cause to be glad that she and Corwin were stuffed into a tiny, confined space. Partly that was because she rarely minded being stuffed into a tiny, confined space with Corwin, and partly it was because she suspected it was the only reason they weren't thrown from the car every time Minami took a corner, because she drove on the public streets exactly the same way as she had on the racetrack. Utena wondered whether the car really had a crash gearbox, or if Minami was just double-clutching to show off. The way the Satos did dinner on the town after a race turned out to be illuminating, and also a ton of fun. After a 5-minute barnstorm into the part of Future City where the factory workers lived, they pulled up outside an utterly nondescript storefront. Once pried out of the back, Utena and Corwin were ushered into an only slightly less cramped space, lacking even tables and chairs. A restaurant that appeared only one weight class up from a dive, and served only one thing. This turned out to be hearty dumplings and soup in the Earth Kingdom style, taken standing up at the counter, and it was as fantastic as the setting was not. And then up the street to another, similar restaurant where they had the most amazing sushi. And then another where the roast duck would blow your mind, and so on. In this way, the foursome described a great circle through the Future City working-class district, pausing again and again for small quantities of spectacularly good food served in completely uninspiring circumstances by surprisingly friendly people. Utena found herself wondering how such a place could possibly remain a secret. Back in Nakomikoka, a district like this would be swarming with foodies and uptown hipsters, roaming around in hungry little packs like wolves and loafers. Or maybe that had already happened, and the fad had petered out, mercifully returning the area to its original quiet excellence?
"Oh, nobody who doesn't work for the company comes down here," Minami reported when Utena put this to her outside the place with the incredible sweet bean rolls.
"They don't dare. They think it's full of bullshy factory workers who would beat them senseless and take their shoes." She grinned. "I think the locals encourage the myth. They like it quiet."
"Would we be in trouble if we weren't with you guys?" Utena wondered.
"Oh no, not at all," Ryo assured her, leaning around the back of his seat to face her. "Even the triads up in Dragon Flats would leave you two alone." He grinned. "They'd take one look at you and know you'd wipe them out if they crossed you. Triads are great judges of character."
"Oh, stop it, Ryo,"
Minami chided him, pulling to a stop in front of their next destination. "You watch too many movies."
Good morning, said Azana cheerfully as the two finally trailed into the Phoenix House lobby at 2:30 a.m. Someone's been out celebrating.
It was like a pub crawl, Utrina explained, only with food instead of booze.
Well, Azana mused, riffling through the card index on her desk behind the counter, I'll just put you down for late checkout, shall I?
Thanks, said Utrina. Listen, if we don't see you again before we leave, I want to thank you for taking such good care of us.
So do I, Corbin agreed, nodding. It's been really great.
Azana's smile was a tad enigmatic as she replied, Oh, I expect you'll be seeing me again soon. But you're very welcome. We've enjoyed having you here, and we hope you come again.
I wonder what she meant by that, Utrin mused once they were back in the Avatar suite.
Beats me, said Corwin, with a shrug that turned into a gargantuan yawn.
Oh, man.
I forgot how exhausting it is hanging out with those two. At least they're not drinkers.
Utrina grinned.
Are you getting old? She wondered.
No, you're wearing me out, he replied with a faint smirk that earned him a punch in the shoulder.
They changed for bed and crashed, like the night before, too tired and replete with the day's adventures to bother with anything else.
You know what the best part was?
Utrina asked after the lights were out.
Hmm? Corwin responded.
The contrast. Last night, super elegant dinner and dancing. Tonight, street food standing up in a blue-collar part of town. And I can't say either one was better than the other.
She hugged him from behind, arms crossing over his chest.
This has been amazing. Thank you.
Wouldn't have been half as good without you, Corwin replied. But you're very welcome, Elsker. Thank Cora, too, he added, the smile evident in his voice. It was her idea.
Oh, I intend to, Utrina assured him. I intend to.
Airy Productions Unlimited and Magnetic Terrapin Studios presented Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, The Legacy of Korra, and The Order of the Rose. Suite for Avatar and Trinity, the Dicho Suite. First movement, Honeymoon by the Sea. The Dicho Suite will continue in the second movement, What's Past is Prologue.